May it please the Court. My name is Daniel Musser, and I represent William Dinga. I'd first like to talk about the District Court's determination to add a two-level upward departure from the guidelines for obstruction of justice. Mr. Dinga, first of all, was acquitted of three of the four counts in the superseding indictment. The jury believed that Mr. Dinga truthfully stated on the ATF forms at Big Bear Sports that he was the true, real purchaser of the firearms. However, Mr. Dinga was convicted of later lying to the ATF agent that his guns were stolen from his automobile. The district court held that no reasonable person, no reasonable jury could possibly believe Mr. Dinga's story. It was preposterous. However, the jury believed that the guns were purchased for himself. The fact that the guns were purchased for himself and later he states they were stolen makes reasonable sense. I don't believe it's preposterous. I don't believe that any reasonable jury could not find that. Beyond that, the government produced no evidence, absolutely none, that the guns were not stolen. They just chose not to believe Mr. Dinga. So he stated his story on the record. No evidence was supplied beyond Mr. Dinga's statement that the guns were not stolen. No guns were recovered. Nothing in the record indicates that guns who Mr. Dinga allegedly gave or stole these guns to. No evidence. No guns were ever recovered, as far as the record is concerned, as far as I know. Additionally, Mr. Dinga, prior to being interviewed by law enforcement, prior to being contacted by law enforcement, told the government witness, Mr. Camps, the owner of the gun shop, that the guns were stolen.
But, of course, when he testified, he was cross-examined, wasn't he?
Correct.
And during the cross-examination, he admitted that he lied when he said he didn't have a driver's license. He admitted he lied about writing his driver's license on a piece of paper, that the firearms were at his girlfriend's house, that finding the money for the purchase of the firearms was on April 9th, that one of the guns was being taken out of the car, and he had been approached by some. I mean, in the cross-examination, all these various lies he told at various times were brought out.
Well, Mr. Dinga admitted that he made these lies. These lies were made very, very early on in the investigation. Mr. Dinga had a history of, and he testified to this, distrust of law enforcement. He was approached by, I believe it's the Wood County Sheriff's Department. He was approached by the ATF agent. He was scared. Once the interview proceeded, probably not that long, he told the truth. The guns were stolen, and he's kept that story since the time.
But now, he never reported the theft of the handguns on March 8th, is that right?
That's correct. He did report, however, the theft of the guns at a later date. However, he did tell the gun store owner, he did tell his mother, and both witnesses testified that that he stated that the guns were stolen. And the only evidence is that the government has is that is Mr. Dinga's testimony. Nothing beyond that. Any questions from the court? We'll also proceed to the polygraph argument.
Sure.
During the course of the investigation, Mr. Dinga stated that he was willing to take a polygraph test. This was after the ATF agent, Mr. Salerno, asked him to. At that point, he did not have counsel. He did not have any reason to believe that polygraph examinations were not admitted in court. This is an indication of his innocence, just like fleeing or failure to take
These lie detector tests are very, very unreliable, and there are ways of beating them. So I don't think a judge abuses her discretion when she says, no, this is just confusing and not probative.
However, Your Honor, the issue, our position is that the issue is not their relative value. Because Mr. Dinga, or the average person, does not know the relative value or the relative accuracy of a polygraph test.
How do you know what he knows? Would that be some kind of issue for trial, of voir dire on what he knows about polygraphs? It's a very complicated issue, whether they're reliable, what people think, whether you can beat them, taking drugs, lowering your body temperature. It's all very complicated and uncertain. I think injecting it into a trial would be very confusing to people.
Well, I'm not arguing that any result of a polygraph would be accepted, just
right.
His original statement that he's willing to take it.
He's willing. And so do you have any case law to support that position? Because we certainly haven't accepted that here in the Seventh Circuit.
There's Wisconsin case law that has held that it is consciousness of innocence.
Well, it can be.
Mr. Mandel placed that in his brief.
I mean, you might offer to take a polygraph test because you were you realized you had absolutely no defense, and your hope would be that even if polygraph tests are often accurate, that you get lucky and you pass, and maybe they wouldn't prosecute you. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Musser. Mr. Jarosz?
Thank you, Your Honor. If I can just go to the polygraph exam first, is that as the court's well aware, as a matter of discretion for the district court, whether to admit the offer to take the polygraph, she did not believe the court that this was a sincere offer. She felt that it had little probative value and would just confuse the jury. That's what we argued down below, and then she simply used her discretion not to admit the offer to take the polygraph exam. There really is not much more to the argument. She didn't rule that she wished she could have admitted it, but it was somehow she was bound by some sort of ruling or anything like that.
Did he agree that when he volunteered to take the test, did he agree that the results could be used at trial?
No, Your Honor, and that's the whole
thing. So it's a heads I win, tails you lose sort of thing.
Right. And so... And the government has cited the Colorado decision, which actually collects the set of cases that have discussed the offer to take a polygraph exam. And in that, they note that it is literally a Gordian knot that has to be cut in order to get at the issue, because there's so many things at play. Does the defendant know that they're admissible? Does he know what the effect is going to be, or whether the cops think they're admissible? There's all sorts of things that might be going on in his mind, in which it'd be impossible. You'd have a second mini trial really on irrelevant matters for that purpose. In terms of the alleged enhancement, the court made specific findings independent of what the jury found. What the court found was that the defendant testified falsely, it was on a material issue, and it was willful. She made those findings independently, analyzing each part of the evidence. And he's right. She found the story preposterous. And given the facts in this case, it was indeed preposterous. So addressing that issue, again, no clear error on the part of the judge in making that ruling and in that enhancement. The final issue, which really wasn't brought up, was the sufficiency of the evidence, although it was alluded to briefly by the defense counsel. In this case, because of the failure to renew the motion for acquittal at the end of the trial, we're dealing with a plain error standard. So not only is there the large burden of trying to prove there was insufficient evidence, but now it's even made even larger because it's a plain error standard of review. And under the facts in this case, there is both direct and circumstantial evidence that the defendant was, in fact, lying to the police officer when he said the guns were stolen. His initial statement after he'd been confronted with two or three of the lies was he said, well, now, look, I'll tell you the truth. What happened was a guy approached me, asked me to buy the guns for him, so I did it. Well, what's that guy's name? Well, I don't want to tell you that. I'm too scared. And then the ATF agent, instead of at that point throwing the cuffs on him and sending him away, said, well, you know what you just told me, that's illegal. Oh, okay, well, now let me tell you another story. And that's how we get the multiple stories and multiple lies that occur in this case. And ultimately, the jury found that the defendant did, in fact, lie to the ATF agent. That's really the only issue, is whether it was a false material lie. In fact, it was, and the jury found him guilty. The government would ask that the court here affirm the district court's order of judgment of conviction, and if there are no further questions, I have nothing more to say.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Yarosh. Mr. Musser, would you like another minute? Let me just ask you, Mr. Musser, however, why don't you come up? I have a question for you. Had your client agreed that if he took a polygraph test, the results would be admissible?
He had no knowledge one way or the other.
What do you mean, no knowledge?
He didn't know if it would be admissible or inadmissible.
He could certainly waive any objection to admissibility, couldn't he? Wouldn't it be appropriate in any case in which someone wanted to testify that he had volunteered to take a polygraph test, wouldn't a threshold condition be that he agreed that the results could be produced at trial?
I believe that he did not have knowledge either one way or the other, and I think that's sufficient. I don't think it has to be an affirmative knowledge that it can be used at trial.
You're not following my question. Shouldn't it be a condition of anyone who wants to testify that he offered to take a polygraph test? Shouldn't he also have to say, and I agreed that if I took the test, the results would be admissible at my trial?
I don't think that's necessary.
Why not?
Because he also did not testify.
That's a heads I win, tails you lose situation, which say, yeah, I'll take a polygraph test, but of course, if I fail, it's not going to be used against me. So there's no cost.
Well, there's no testimony that he believed that it was not admissible.
Hypothetical. Yeah. I'm just saying, if you want this evidence in about people offering, I'm not suggesting it should be, but if you were to allow evidence that the person volunteered to take the test, wouldn't it be an appropriate condition to impose on it that the test results be admissible? Otherwise, he has no. It's completely costless to him to make that offer.
Well,
no risk.
I agree with the court that if there's testimony that he believed that they were inadmissible, then he certainly.
Belief. I'm asking you, should it be a condition of anyone who wants to testify that he offered to take a polygraph test, shouldn't it be a condition that had you agreed that the results would be admissible?
It's a reasonable condition.
Mr. Musser, you mentioned the state of the law in Wisconsin on polygraphs.
Yes.
Do any of those cases speak to what Judge Posner is making inquiry about as a condition?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Russell. And you were appointed, and we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client.